Welcome to Reporter's Notebook on universityaffairs.ca. I'm Tara Seabarth, web editor for University Affairs magazine. In this episode, our news editor, Rosanna Tamburi, speaks with Ross Finney, director of the Education Policy Research Initiative at the University of Ottawa and a longtime researcher on post-secondary issues. Recently, Dr. Finney and his colleagues at EPRI completed a major study that used income tax records to track the before-tax earnings of graduates from the University of Ottawa from 1999 to 2011. Dr. Finney's group matched 98% of graduates with bachelor's degrees with at least one tax year, resulting in a dataset of 82,000 students. So who came out on top? Listen as Dr. Finney shares his findings and provides some advice to students and parents.
So, your study used tax records to track the earnings of 82,000 students at the University of Ottawa with bachelor degrees over a 13-year period.
Correct.
How did the graduates fare overall?
Well, one of the reactions of people who see these results are, these look great. In a context where there is such questioning of the value of a university degree, people are looking at these and saying, these results look pretty good. Those earnings are pretty good. So mean earnings of upwards of the lowest group, I think, is around 70-some thousand dollars on average, 13 years after graduation. So they're still just in their mid-30s, by and large. People see that as being the start on a good start on some decent careers.
And were they largely working in their field? Were you able to tell?
No. But first of all, I always lean against that question a bit because on some level, I don't know if we really care.
Mm-hmm.
That is to say, there's so many discussions I'm in these days, a morning full of them just today, about what is it a university degree is all about. Now, in college, it'd be a different thing. You know, you get a specific skill set of skills that have more or less direct application to a particular kind of job. So you want to probably make sure that there is this sort of graduates are going into areas where they're using their skills. But university degrees, famously, are sets of general skills. So communication skills, critical thinking, presentation skills, those are the sorts of things that can get applied in a lot of different kinds of job situations. And I've been looking at school to work transition for many years, and it's a transition, it's an evolution. So they hit the market, labor market, they find their way around, they find a place to apply those skills, and then off they go. And those skills are the ones they developed and the ones that work out, but there's not always that tight a match, so it doesn't really matter.
So it doesn't really matter what if they were working in their field or not.
Now, I say that, even engineers, for example, surprisingly, if you look at engineers, only about half of engineering graduates are working in occupations that you would call engineering. What are they doing? Well, they're in business, they're in communications, they're in finance, they're in all kinds of areas where they are using those skills, but not as engineers as we normally use that occupational title. So now, all that said, if we could know that as well, that'd be great. And for example, those who are working, particularly where they're using their skills, do they do better or worse than others? That would be interesting to know. So there are other things that definitely would be interesting to know. We can't do that with these data, though.
Okay. But you did look at earnings by discipline, and I guess this is what every parent wants to know. So which graduates came up on top? At least by field of study, if not what field they were working in.
Well, first of all, I think parents should mind their business. and I would encourage them to do so, but that's my own, that goes beyond the scope of the data. But they'd be interested, and I understand that. I'm a parent as well. I would say one of the interesting findings is even the much maligned humanities, social sciences, they do pretty well. And so I think this whole idea that's out there that studying something in those areas is useless, or why would you want to do that, is largely based on anecdotes. I don't think it's got an appreciation for how things actually do work in reality, and their disregard of the data that do exist. These data, because they're a very unique way of following graduates from specific areas of study through their early years in the labor market, then reinforce that idea that there's lots of areas where people could study and do very well. And I think probably, again, this goes beyond the scope narrowly of the analysis, but I always encourage young people to follow what they're passionate about, what they're interested in, what grabs them. And then they'll enjoy it. Partly because of that, they'll do well. And then with that, they will then perhaps be able to build the careers that would really make them happy people.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that said, it's good to know what those earnings patterns look like, so people are aware. So they should be informed, but make those choices, and there don't seem to be any, particularly across the board, along these wide areas of study, there's no obvious bad choices.
So can you tell me a bit more about how the different disciplines fared? Because they all did fairly well, as you mentioned. Yeah.
Well, interestingly, for example, start with the social sciences. That's one of the big areas. They start, and we tracked these different cohorts. So the ones that finished in 1998, that was the earliest set of graduates we were able to identify and work with. We were able to follow them right through to, we followed everyone through to 2011. So we followed them for 13 years. And they started around just under $40,000, and they wound up just under $80,000. So their earnings more or less doubled.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the, and if you look at all the different cohorts, and those who graduated in 99, 2000, 2000, right through, there's some variation, but by and large, they were all pretty much on the same kind of trajectory. So let's say starting around 40, finishing a little under 80, and all the same, roughly, similar. Then if you took the look at humanities, another big group, of course, they start about the same, just under 40 on average across one cohort in and out, and then they finish somewhat lower, around 70, tad over 70, so from about 40 to 70, and again, very similar over time. Then you take the third group, which is health graduates, and that's not doctors, it's physiotherapists, it's nurses, it's that sort of thing, the professionals. And this gets back to the skills issue. They start higher. They start to average earnings are close to $50,000 by and large, but they don't rise nearly as much over time. So they actually finish the 13 years later lower than the other two groups. And that's important to understand the longer term perspective that we have here. Is important because if people are thinking about careers, a career by definition is something that lasts over a long time. And if you just look at the situation a few years out, which, by the way, is what most of these so-called key performance indicators do, they give a very different story than what looks like what things look like further out in time. So health graduates start higher, but they don't grow as much. But again, pretty similar across all cohorts. Then the last three groups, math and computer science, engineers, and then the business, they all earn higher earnings, by and large, but there's much more variability across cohorts. So depending on when you hit the market, your fortunes may differ quite a bit from one group to another. So higher earnings, but more variability over time. That's kind of it in a nutshell.
So because the study spanned 13 years, from 1998 to 2011, it captured the effects of some major economic impacts, shocks, including the dot-com bust of 2001 and the recession of 2008. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a bit about what impact these events had on graduate earnings and who it affected the most?
Yeah, well, the dot-com bust is the most dramatic change. And, of course, and that's a very interesting one from a policy perspective as well, because things, of course, the areas, we had we had two papers here, two pieces of work to be done. One is across all areas of study, and the other one focused on particularly ICT graduates, information communication technology, the people that would normally go into the dot-com sort of areas, that sort of area of occupations. And as 98 graduates, those were our first ones, they hit the labor market, you know, they were making $60,000 right off the bat, more than that. And then earnings, so next year out, nice increases next year, and then bang, the dot-com bust hit, and their earnings actually dropped significantly. They then recovered over time, but nothing like that initial trajectory would have suggested. Then the later cohort, they hit the labor market actually higher earnings because the boom was still booming. And then, of course, their earnings dropped the same year. 2001 is when it happened. And they, too, experienced that decline and recovery over time. Then the third, the next cohort, 2000, that was starting earnings even higher. But actually, the first year after that, their second year in labor market, their earnings dropped. So they had a taste of that boom, and then the bottom fell out. Earnings dropped something like, I don't know, I can't remember, $10,000, something like that, from the high 80s, excuse me, high 70s, dropped around 10,000. And their earnings recovered again, but nothing like the initial trajectory. Then starting earnings, because that was after 2001, fell precipitously so that these ICT graduates, their first year earnings, the 98 cohort were the highest, the boom was about almost $80,000, high 70s. And by the lowest point, when the bust had really busted completely, they were down to the mid 40s. So starting earnings dropped more than $35,000.
Wow.
Over a period of 3 or 4 years.
So when you graduate, is an important factor in determining future earnings.
Very important. In particular for those areas of study that are more susceptible to the particular things going on in the labor market. Again, because that's where they're going to work. So if that area where they're going to work basically hits the skids, their careers kind of hit the skids. Whereas, again, going back to the social science, humanities, there's no such particular sector that they're headed for, so they're insured, in some sense, by precisely this general nature of their skills and the wide areas of employment where they might find work. So, very different stories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's largely a good news story for young people, I think, looking at post-secondary today. But one discouraging finding had to do with the wage gap between male and female graduates, which existed in all disciplines and even in the first year after graduation, before child rearing was even a factor.
Yeah, well, that varied by area of study.
Did it?
Was particularly true amongst the engineers and in the more math science areas. And to be fair, we can't say, it's hard to go further than that, but you're right, in the area of social science, humanities, health, the gap started, in that case, it started, more or less there was no gap, and then it grew over time. So different stories across disciplines. Not sure yet what that is. We can dig deeper into that. So, for example, did the engineering gap between men and women, is that because women study different areas of engineering? That could explain it. Or perhaps, no, they had that gap right from the beginning, no matter what they studied. That would be interesting to look at.
You don't know that yet.
Not yet. We can't. But the other is sort of two broad possibilities. One is that over time, 2, 5, 6, 13 years into the labor market, men and women make different choices. You might make different choices with respect to hours work, with respect to the specific career opportunities they pursue. Maybe they take time off because women still tend to do that more than men, considerably so, when there are children. So it could be, in that sense, explained by the behavior of differences in behavior of men and women choices. So on the other side, though, is it could be just discrimination, and it takes a little while as careers evolve, the discrimination comes into play more and more. And that's a hard one. That's always a hard problem to sort out, because the data are always limited what you can actually see. That's one side of it. Then the other side is it gets even more complex, because some of those choices men and women make may themselves be the result of discrimination. So, for example, let's say men start to earn more than women, and so if someone's going to cut back a number of hours, well, it better be the person maybe who is not making quite as much, and so that reinforces the decision. So the gender gap, long studied, continues to be studied, important, and it's a hard question that we're still trying to sort out. This gives a different perspective on it, a little bit of a contribution to that literature then.
So I understand that you plan to expand the project.
Yes.
Okay, so how so?
In fact, right now, yes. We now have an extended, we started with one institution, University of Ottawa. They went out there and said, yes, let's do this. And now, on the basis of those initial results, we are now moving ahead with a total of 12 institutions.
Can you say who they are?
I'd leave that for the institution. No, I'd rather not say, but let's say there's a nice selection of some of the large research-intensive universities, some smaller universities. There's some of the very large trade schools. There's some of the mixed colleges, some small colleges. So diversity with respect to university college sector. The kinds of institutions on each side, and we have diversity across the country. We have it right from the West Coast to the very East Coast, and so it'll be very interesting to see how much these results generalize or vary from one area, from one institution to another. At the same time, we're also, others want to get on board this project because they see the potential of it, both institutions who want to be part of it and contribute their data, and then policy-making community that sees the potential to answer a lot of interesting questions that relate to education, that relate to the labor market, and relate to the interaction between the two, skills issues. So what should PSC institutions be doing, post-secondary education institutions be doing? How responsive are they? What should young people study? So I think now that people see what can be done, there's lots of interest. And I think there's huge potential going forward.
When do you expect to have the results?
That next stage, certainly by this time next year, and probably before that, possibly summer, early fall for our first results at least. So not that long. One great thing about using administrative data is they're already there. You don't have to go out and collect them. You don't have to design a survey. You don't have to put that survey in the field, and then you don't have to wait for time, year after year after year. The data are already there. Those students have already graduated. The information on those students is sitting in admin files. The tax data are there. So really, you take advantage of all this existing information. You link it together, and you have a remarkable resource in going backwards in time and going forwards in time.
And how do you compile this data while maintaining the anonymity of the graduates?
Oh, absolutely. That's very important. First of all, our research group, we never see anything, all the individual identifiers are all stripped off. And all of this is done, there's a set of protocols about how the data are shipped off to Statistics Canada. And that's where it all happens. Statistics Canada, they're the masters of this. They know how to do the linkages, and they are certainly in the business of protecting individual confidentiality. But in a nutshell, the institutions send the information needed to link to tax data, just that file. Those data are linked, so students are linked to their tax data. Those files are deleted, and then the rest of the information used to do the analysis is sent, separate file, with no individual true identifiers, to Statistics Canada. Then those two sets of data are linked, and then all identifiers are stripped off the data, and that's what is available for analysis. And then even at that point, everything has to be done according to the very strict protocols StatsCan has in place to make sure to fail safe that individual information will never be released. And finally, only aggregate and level analysis ever comes out anyway. There's no information on any individual student that would ever be released. So it's pretty secure right along the line. Individual student confidentiality is guaranteed.
I just want to ask one last question, and that's about, in the study you mentioned that relatively little is known about the lowest income group across disciplines, and that in the future you were hoping that having a broader data set would help you look at more at that group. What are you hoping to find out?
Yeah, that's a very interesting group. In each area of study, what we did is we grouped the students from each area of study into those who, in each year, those who the top 20% earners, the next 20%, the next 20, the next 20, and the bottom 20. And we calculated mean earnings for each of those groups. And those results were quite interesting, too, across discipline, across the areas of study. Who was at the top? For example, the real high earners were in business, and engineering did quite well as well. But right in the middle of the pack, remarkable similarity across all areas of study. That was one thing we found. But then, as you say, there was this low earnings group, those in the bottom 20%. And what I'm curious about is you hear all this discussion about universities failing students. That is to say, they're not providing with the skills, why should students be going, etc., etc. One, and the way we can investigate that, obviously we can't address that whole question, you never can. But one thing we could do is link how people do in the labor market after graduation to their grades while in study at university, and right along the way. And then also we actually have information on their high school grades based on their admission application to the universities. And so what we could do is find out essentially to what degree are those students who are not doing well in the labor market after graduation, to what degree were they actually not performing very well as students while in PSC, and perhaps were not doing very well as students even before they came into BSC, that is, say, at the end of high school. So maybe, it's a hypothesis, those lower-end students are post-graduation, were low-performing students while in school, and it's just a continuation of this low performance. Conversely, maybe they're good students, and they just got dumped out in the labor market in a way that they did badly. And first of all, that is a whole different kind of dynamic. And then we'd want to understand what's related to doing badly. Why do bad things happen to good people? What was that book years ago? but to understand that. And that would be one of the next things that we hope to get at.
So there's lots more to come.
Oh, there's lots and lots more to come.
That sounds very interesting.
Yeah, we think so.
Yes.
We have lots of fun with this. We think every day we look at the results and say, isn't that interesting?
Yeah. How many students do you think you'll have altogether at the end of this? Do you know?
Well, right now we have 12 institutions. Number of students I've never thought to count it up, but over, you know, we have these multiple years cohorts of graduates. It just depends, but there'll be hundreds and hundreds of thousands for sure. And then Statistics Canada also, this is feeding into a broader program where Statistics Canada hopes to use data that are already being sent to them from the institutions to actually expand not as in-depth a sort of a study, but a similar tracking of, as we hope to do, but a similar tracking of outcomes for, in the limit, all graduates from all institutions across the country. And that is feasible.
Is it? Yes. All graduates going back to the very early beginnings?
No, this would be, it's all dependent on quality of the data, and it would seem that probably going back to 2005 or 6 would be about what you could do for the greater number of institutions across the country. But already that's not bad, and then going forward you'd be adding a year of a new year of graduates, a new cohort of graduates every year, and you'd be tracking everyone you already have for yet one more year, every year we go forward in time.
Mm-hmm. And this is the data that everybody's been clamoring for, right?
I would say so.
Yeah,
and it's clamoring from all perspectives. It's from thinking about the various skills issues, skill shortages, the responsiveness of the post-secondary education system, employers, policymakers, but perhaps most of all, simply students making career decisions. And that's, as you say, it comes back to, I'd say in a nutshell, what's the one thing that's come out of this study? The most important thing is young people looking at areas like social science, humanities, and seeing that you can actually make a decent career in those areas of study. It's been that way for a long time, and it seems to continue to be the case. That's pretty valuable.
They won't end up as a barista.
By and large, no. Well, they might for a little while, but that's part of the process. If you're a philosophy graduate, maybe, you know, that's part of what you do. But then you bump into someone who works in a tech sector, and they think you're pretty smart, and then you have good communication skills, and then maybe you mix it, you develop other skills because what you've learned to do is think and learn how to learn and learn how to communicate, and then off you go.